Morning, Honourable Member. Thank you for waiting patiently. Most welcome, and to the representative of the department, most welcome. We're happy that the storm didn't catch you. they say that Cape Town, there's no water, that even when the first rain comes, has to be a holiday, so schools are closed, universities are closed today, but we are here. A special welcome back to our content advisor. Wow. We hope that your bundle of joy is growing well. Our child, we really missed you, and we welcome you back. Thank you. This morning we be getting a briefing on the research and development in the tax incentive program. But before that, we'll ask members of the committee to introduce myself. My name is Lindwe Masebo. I'm the chairperson of the committee.
My name is Maguza Landomyeni, member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Agnes Fack, member of the committee.
And Nick Gornock, member of the committee.
Good morning, Amelie Lotrit, member of the committee.
Good morning, Chantal King, member of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Renee Osborne Mullins, the content advisor for the committee.
I'm Kasar Matale, committee member.
Thank you.
I'm Nangula Mavungu, I'm from GSA, R&D Tax Incentive.
Good morning, I'm Godfrey Mashamba from Department of Science and Technology.
Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Srini Paramo, I'm from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, members. Imran Patel from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, members. My name is Tom Sugnandan from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Shumi Pango from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning. I'm Carol van Beck from the Department of Science and Technology. Good morning, honorable chairperson, honorable members of parliament, delegation of the department. My name is Ashley Nadine from the parliamentary monitoring group. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Marco Schmidt. I'm the parliamentary liaison officer for the German Consulate General.
Good morning. My name is Christopher and I'm from Sevenet. Thank you.
Shanaz Isaacs, committee secretary.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and once again, welcome. We can now go and have the... Yeah, Mr. Patel.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm just going to introduce the item. Godfrey Mashamba will take people through the presentation. The sense we got is to give an overall feedback on the R&D tax incentive. Just to alert the committee that the tax incentive would be about 10 years that it's been in place since its introduction in 2007. So we would be providing an update based on a sense of how this tax incentive has materialized over that period. But I'll leave it up to Godfrey to do the presentation, and then we'll take questions. Thanks.
Tom, can you please switch off your mic? You're eager to say something.
Thank you once again, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, and for the introduction by Mr. Patel. The presentation on the R&D, Research and Development Tax Incentive, it covers two things. I for purpose of briefing the portfolio committee,
the status update on the processing of applications at the first of June, the latest figures we have in terms of processing applications. The second part of the presentation is the briefing of the committee on the submission of 2015-16 annual report to Parliament in terms required in terms of Section 11B17 of the Income Tax Act. As overview of the R&D tax incentives, any company that undertakes research and development in South Africa qualifies for a 150% tax deduction on their R&D expenditure in terms of Section 11D of the Income Tax Act. This is part of the package of policy instruments that South Africa have to promote innovation, to enhance competitiveness, in order to support growth and economic growth. Through this incentive, the government wants to encourage increased R&D in the business sector, and it's available to firms of any size or industry. It is important to have this type of incentive in order to increase overall investment in the country. As members would know, the medium-term strategic framework has set a target in line with the National Development Plan to grow and expand research and development in the country to about 1.5% of the economic activity GDP. The incentive would help also to promote innovation, because innovation is important for the development of new products, processes and services, to promote technological advancement and competitiveness, and also to secure the growth and expansion of the R&D workforce and the spillovers that are associated with technological development and R&D. So the department administers this program in partnership with the South African Revenue Service and the National Treasury. This slide outlines the process of application. That's where a company submits an application to the Department of Science and Technology. This process was introduced in 2012. Before 2012, companies used to spend on their R&D and claim from SAS on a retrospective basis. But in 2012, the process of pre-approval, where a company, when they want to do R&D, they apply to the DST and get an approval before they can actually claim, was introduced. So a company submits an application to the DST. There is an adjudication committee that has been established jointly by the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Science and Technology, and that committee comprises members from SARS, DST, and also National Treasury. The committee makes recommendations, and the minister approves such recommendations. The letter of approval that the minister provides to the company serves as a proof when the company claims their tax in order for them to get a deduction from SARS. So all the companies that are approved are required to submit progress report to the DST to show the results of their R&D and also progress with whatever they have been approved for. Now, the status as of 31 May 2017, I must say through you, Chair, that we have updated slide number 7, because in order for us to meet the date of circulation to the committee, since that day we circulated, there has been activity, so we had to update this slide in order to provide the latest information. The slide indicates that it categorizes applications in three categories. That's the applications that we received in 2012, between 2012 and December 2015, which we regard as backlog. The department has been dealing with this, focusing on this quite intensely in order to get rid of the backlog and operate at the level where we are at an efficiency level where we can provide applications with decisions within 90 days of applying. So that we manage as backlog. We are only left with 4 applications at that time, whereas we are, in terms of adjudication, and then the stock of applications from January 2016 to December 2016, we are remaining with 64. The applications received in 2017 is 76. Once these applications are adjudicated, they will be subject to the minister's approval for it to be sent back to the companies. So all the pre-2016 applications that are still remaining, the 145 on the last row adjudicated that require sign off by the minister, the 145 applications and the four should have reached the companies in terms of our planning by 31 July 2017. That's what we are working on, Chair and honorable members. So external experts have also been enlisted to assist the DST in evaluating the new applications that we are receiving. There are measures that the minister has introduced to improve efficiency. There was the department working with the National Treasury, SARS. The DST has implemented the recommendation that arose from the joint government industry task team that the minister established in November 2015 to look into possible improvements to the design and implementation of the incentive. We have grouped these actions under four headings. Firstly, is the work on simplifying processes and improving turnaround times to reach the efficiency level of 90 days, providing decisions to companies on applications within 90 days. So in that space, we have improved the guidance for application for applicants through issuing of a new guideline, a version of guideline, addressing the concerns that were raised where there was lack of clarity. We've also updated information on the DST website. We're working also with the one-stop shop with the DTI that was launched a few months ago to interact with investors in that space that are interested in investing in R&D. DST officials are readily available also to meet with businesses at any time, either individually or in groups. I must say we have been interacting lately with various groupings of stakeholders through roadshows, and also the Black Business Council. We must highlight also that we had two sessions that were focused on tax incentives and other aspects of the work of the DST. The rollout of the online system. We have introduced an online system where applicants can apply online now. The specific focus this year will be on optimizing the online system to such an extent that by the end of this financial year, we should be receiving all applications online, fully migrated to the online system. We also continue the use of external experts in order to supplement the capacity of DST for evaluating applications. Under the second heading, there were amendments that were introduced to enable companies to catch up on their claims where they were delayed in providing decisions. So that amendment came into effect in January 2017. We still have to get feedback from SARS and National Treasury about what is the nature of uptake in terms of that amendment. Third heading is the review of the pre-approval procedure. One of the recommendations came out was that the pre-approval procedure that we have implemented makes it difficult for companies to apply. But then again, when we evaluated this DST and the National Treasury, we realized that we need to understand the implications of changing from this system to the new one. And also that if we are operating in a situation of no backlog, whether this is not the appropriate measure. So we are still monitoring this and evaluating the potential implications of changing or not changing before we firm up the decision. But by the end of, towards the end of this year, 2017, we could have reached some decision on this matter. But we have also interacted with practitioners around the world through the forum at the OECD, of countries that are managing these types of incentives, where we exchange knowledge with them. We pick up that some countries are also looking at South Africa as a model of a pre-approval system. And whereas we were studying to say whether why are we so different? Why don't we do things the same way as the others? Others are looking at South Africa to say we want to do things like you. So it's an area of ongoing thinking and analysis. Under heading number 4, actions on policy-related matters that have arisen. There was a number of issues that have arisen from the recommendations that have policy implications which require further consultation and analysis by the two departments. But then again, our initial consultations between DST and National Treasury resolved that we are not going to prioritize increasing the rate the incentive from 150% as it was suggested by that task team, not now, because the conditions are not right. Then the new guidelines that we've provided, I think some questions that were asked about eligibility of software development, R&D collaboration, eligibility of small medium enterprises and startup firms, we thought in our analysis that it is not necessary to make changes drastically. Rather, we clarify the areas that were not clear through the guidelines and see how it works. And where there are challenges, industry will continue helping government by giving us feedback where there are constraints so that the government can analyze this and see whether it's necessary to make amendments. And for sure, we have been meeting on a quarterly basis between DST and National Treasury tax policy on these issues to try and monitor the situation. And the DST and National Treasury continue to monitor the feedback, yes, I've already mentioned that, to see if there is need for changes. The discussion that we're having now is around a specific text in the legislation which we think presents some ambiguity, and then we are busy discussing that, and Treasury will be able to update us in terms of whether our views have been taken on board when they consider the next round of legislative amendments. I'm done with the updates. Then we'll go to the submission of the 2015-16 annual report on the R&D tax incentive program. Section 11D-17 of the Income Tax Act requires the Minister of Science and Technology to report to Parliament annually on the direct benefits of the R&D activities encouraged by the incentive program in terms of how it's contributing to economic growth, employment and other broader government objectives. We have noted the comments that came in the Minister's budget vote speech requiring that DST present, asking the Minister about when are we going to present this report to Parliament. But by that time, the report had already served in Cabinet. On the 15th of February, Cabinet approved that the report be tabled to Parliament. So the content of the report is that it tracks the activities of the incentives based on identified performance indicators that are listed there, the uptake and the nature of firms that are participating, R&D personnel of the supported R&D, amounts of R&D expenditure, tax expenditure foregone, and how the incentive is supporting the priority areas of the industrial policy action plan. So because the incentive has, since 2006, there were two administrative systems, procedures that were implemented from 2006, October 2012, and from October 2012 to now. We tend to, where appropriate, present figures in cumulative terms so that we see the overall picture. Although the report is about the annual, the year under review. In 2015-16, in summary, there were 189 applications received by the department from 147 companies. And we also note that 86 of those companies that applied that year were applying for the first time. Every year we receive applications from new applicants. And all those applications in that year had estimated R&D of 3.9 billion rand. This summarizes in cumulative terms the story from November 2006 February 2016, to also include the part on the far, depending on where one sits, on the far end of the slide, the 1575 that we received through a retrospective procedure, and the ones that the 1013 that we received through the pre-approval system, indicating how many were adjudicated at that time and how many were remaining at that time, including those that were approved, how many companies were granted approval, those that were not approved, and the companies as such. The big point that we note here is that by the end of that reporting period, the DST had a completed adjudication on 73% of the 1013 pre-approval applications, and 367, which is about 49% of them, were approved, covering 292 companies that would access the incentive. In terms of approvals, this is a breakdown of approvals in terms of size. Of those 749 adjudicated applications spread across companies in terms of size, what we note from this slide, which is now the text in slide number 17, says that larger companies have higher rates of approval than SMEs and are dominant in terms of a number of applications received and the estimated amount of R&D expenditure. Partly this indicates that SMEs, if it's a problem of applications, SMEs need support in terms of preparation of application and understanding the eligibility criteria of the incentive. But also, that some of the SMEs that apply here, when we look at the type of activities that they have in there, it's innovative activities that they are not necessarily undertaking R&D. That is, you can introduce innovation without undertaking R&D. So that is addressed through other programs of government, such as the SPI program, which is managed by the DTI, and the Technology Innovation Agency, which has certain other programs, whereas the R&D tax incentives deals with R&D as defined under Section 11D of the Act. This slide provides a disaggregation in terms of industry sectors, and then in this slide, we'll explain the content of this slide in the next slide number 19. There are two, if you cut the slide in the middle, the industries on the left-hand side of the screen, they receive most approvals than non-approvals, but those that are on the right-hand side, they receive non-approvals more than the approvals. There are reasons to explain this, which we have outlined in our analysis, that particularly in the financial and business sector, we find that most of those implementing ICT activities are actually not approved, are actually buying off the shelf technologies and installing them to improve their process, which is an innovative activity, but they are not actually developing a technology or doing R&D or creating a new software or something like that. So that's why they happen not to be approved. In terms of the estimated R&D expenditure supported, since 2006, 36.1 billion rand is estimated in the applications that we've received. Of all those that were approved, they have that amount. This is an aggregation of the two figures, those that came through retrospective system and those that came through a pre-approval system. In R&D personnel, we note that about 19,500 of R&D personnel are involved in the R&D supported by the incentive. We think that this is an undercount of the potential employment or human resource impact of the supported R&D, because further employment can arise from successful R&D once it's introduced into markets as successful innovation. but also the knowledge that gained from just undertaking R&D, it's irreplaceable. It contributes to further human capital stock and the spillovers in the system of innovation, because people that do R&D in one company move to others, they introduce further innovation in that way, so there's those type of spillovers that we see. The incentive also shows a strong orientation of supporting priority focus areas of the industrial policy action plan, with about 59%, about 219 of those applications that were approved, they address the IPAP priority areas, and these account for about 57% of the approved R&D expenditure. And we have listed the top five IPAP sectors that are supported, as electrotechnical and ICT, upstream oil and gas, chemicals and pharmaceuticals, and plastics, the metal fabrication, capital equipment, as well as forestry, pulp and furniture. To end the presentation, we recommend that the Portfolio Committee of Science and Technology on Science and Technology notes the 2015-16 report on performance of R&D tax incentive submitted to Parliament, and the status update that was presented up to the end of May 2017. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mashamba, for the presentation, update, and then explanation in some of the areas. I will now give an opportunity to honorable members to pose their questions, comments, or whatever. Honorable Matale, Honorable Goronoff, Honorable Ndongeni, that order.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I want to be helped to understand the 150% incentive. What does it practically mean? In terms of transformation of the economy, how does this program contribute towards that? The structures that you know, as you are presenting, I came to the conclusion that generally the people who will benefit from these schemes are those who know the system, or who participated in the process of the creation of the tax incentive itself, because that legislation came as a result of, okay, it was crafted and there were public hearings, and people participated. I did not participate, and I have no clue about how the whole thing works, but I'm quite certain that industry, different sectors of the industry participated in that, and in the main those that are established, and in South Africa established industries generally racially based because of our history. Now when they apply, some of us who did not participate will have heard that there is this tax incentive, and will then put an application which, in terms of your explanation, falls outside the scope of research and development. How do you deal with that? If I apply and my application is irrelevant to what you do, what do you do? Do you put it aside and say it does not qualify, or you refer that to the relevant section that deals with that? For instance, you talked of innovation, that this belongs to this area, which is a different component within science and technology. is there a relationship between yourselves and this other section in the form, that if you receive something that falls outside your scope, but it falls within a different scope within the agencies of DST, how do you relate with that? Or it's just that, oh, this one does not qualify, you put aside, you only focus on those that are relevant to you. The status update on processing of applications, I see that you have got a very big number of applications that have been adjudicated, but have not been, the letter have not arrived in some, I think here it's about almost 200. Or let me say, yeah, almost 200 or 193 to be specific. What is the problem? Because once everything has been approved, you just need a letter. There is no research that somebody must do. They must just write a letter that your application has been approved, and then there it is. That number, I think, is too much. Well, not that the 51 for the secretariat is too little. It's not. It's a very huge number, because the secretariat does not do any further research. Once the things have been approved and it goes to the desk of a secretariat, the job of the secretariat is to just write the recommendation that this thing has been it has passed adjudication. It needs you to, in fact, they craft the letter that says now, you know, it must go to so and so. Your application has been approved and the minister must sign. Because I take it they draft the letters for the minister to sign. They don't draft something that says this application has passed. Because the adjudication committee does that, in my own interpretation. So what is the explanation? Because to me, it's something that, you know, once it comes to your desk as a secretariat, you don't have to check anything. Because the people who are supposed to check are the adjudication committee. Yours is to prepare a letter of appointment to the minister, who must then sign. And the minister, if the minister sits, is 142. How old are these 142? Are you able to know? For how long must it stay? If it goes to the minister's desk, how long must it stay? I don't know, Chair, but I think...
Now 145 speakers updated.
145? Oh, okay. Yeah, so with that addition, I think it's a very good... program, and like I said, that you know, there this program can help many people who are in business from, you know, across all the sectors to can benefit. I mean, you know, when they produce, they bring a new thing which will enhance their capacity to make more money. I don't think there will be a single business person who won't be interested in investing in R&D, because it's for their own good to make more profit. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Matani. Honorable Corona.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to understand the backlog. When does the time, or the 90 days then, start? When the application is submitted to the department, is that then you've got 90 days, or you strive to do it within 90 days, am I correct? So why is there then a backlog? Is it because you don't have enough staff to do it? That's the first point. And then secondly, 90 days is still too long, you know, really, to... You know, if you're in business, 3 months is just simply too long. You should strive for a shorter period than 90 days. And then, I know you haven't got it here, but maybe you can submit it to us in a later state or in writing. I would like to see the list of companies that was approved and got the incentives, and I want to know why they got the incentives, for what specific reasons. You know, by seeing that, maybe we can try to assist why so few SMMEs are successful, because that is the heart of South Africa. And I don't know, how do you, if I go to your website, will I see exactly how I can apply for the incentive? If that's not on your website, please get it on your website. Otherwise, we're going to miss out on the SMMEs. The big companies, the large companies, they know exactly what to do. But it's the smaller guys that really will depend on this incentive to survive eventually. And making, you know, look at this small company, Get Smarter, that was sold overseas. But it was a small company. It started as a very small company, but it ended up extremely successful. So I would like to see that list.
Thank you, Coroner, from Ndongeni.
Thank you, Chair. The Department and Treasurer are discussing the impact evaluation plan for the incentive. What progress has been made in this regard so far? The second one, are further legislative or structural amendments to the incentive being considered? If yes, what do these comprise? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Ndongeni. Honorable King.
My question is basically on your foregone tax. I see I've got here that for 2014-15, 2015-16, there is no amount indicated. I know you were talking about cumulative, but when I look at this report, it shows you specifically for each year, but I need that amount, please. Also, the impact evaluation plan that was presented, how far are you with implementing it fully, because there was evaluation on that? And also, what measures have you put in place to inform small businesses of this incentive? I did check your website. It is really smooth. All the criteria, everything is on there. So I was quite happy. And then with your tax, I think there might be a duplication with tax in the form that most of these industries have their own research and development funding. And then the Department of Science and Technology have our own. I see you have manufacturing, all of that. Will this then impact on the DSTs when they apply, or will it specifically then link to the industry itself? Because I can see there might be a tax duplication taking place there.
Thank you, honorable members. Just on the last one that Honorable King raised, I just wanted to know where is the monitoring and evaluation, because I think the aim is to see how far are we towards the 1.5% of the GDP. And so as it's in different sectors, so the must be one area that monitors and evaluates that and report centrally, I don't know, so that then that. But I also wanted to raise the issue that Honorable Matali raised, and Honorable Korong, the issue of the those adjudicated submissions that are sitting on the minister's desk. Is it the minister's advisory committee, or who then advises the minister? Because I agree that when you have an adjudication team, and you even have external experts to supplement, because you brought in external supplements to to supplement the capacity of DST. So if that's the case, then it needs to move faster and smoother, because I probably can confirm that the experts that you bring in would be in certain expert areas that the capacity that DST doesn't have, but needs to be part of complying with the requirements for them to benefit the tax incentive, and also the 150. I've always asked myself, why 150? Why is it more than 100%? If you could do that. And I agree that the 90 days for me is just too long, because for me the longest period should be around where the adjudicators, the expert committee, adjudicates and then signs off to say we have satisfied ourselves. Then the secretariat and the minister must not reopen the process. A team that is paid to do that, they earn a salary or a commission or whatever, to do that kind of work, and needs to do that. So mustn't regurgitate the process after that. Thank you. Mr. Patel?
Chair, I'll ask the colleagues to answer, and then I'll clean up or do a sweep as Thomas did.
You're taking the more difficult ones, give them the easier ones.
Then.
Thank you. In answering the questions that were raised, they are quite important. We also grapple with them at the DST. The reason why I'll start with this one on the backlog and why are so many adjudicated applications sitting with the minister. There is a historical fact here that when there was a much bigger backlog, what we are presenting today, there's a lot of progress that has been made to actually clear that. When we migrated from the previous retrospective system to the pre-approval system in October 2012, just in 1 month, about 200 applications came all at once in 1 month, and I think the department was not having ready capacity to actually evaluate these applications at that time. And the same secretariat, which is the unit that I used to deal with the retrospective, did not change in form or size or in terms of the skill staff. So that was the same team that was supposed to evaluate the applications, and it took some time to actually get things going. So about 6 months, first 6 months, there was no activity. Then the adjudication committee started working on the adjudications, and the backlog that has built up from 1 year to the other has actually persisted. Up to a point where the department I appointed the external experts to assist with the evaluation of a application. But then the build-up in the secretariat is because not all those applications were being evaluated by external experts for reasons of saving costs also on the part of the department. There were applications that continued to be evaluated by the DST staff, which are members of the secretariat, and those that required external expertise or specialized expertise to be allocated to external people to do. So secretariat had dual roles in this case in the beginning, up to a point where we learned that we have to allocate all these applications to external experts to evaluate. But you are right, the time and the numbers are just too large. It's what is preoccupying the department currently to try and get that right. We think also the experimentation with the pre-approval process has actually taught the department a number of reasons around capacity planning, which we are still grappling with at the moment. The 150% translates into 14 cents per every rand on the approved expenditure. So for every rand a company spends, they can benefit 14 cents. That's how it translates by chairperson. The issue around transformation of the economy, that the benefit seems to accrue to the same group that knows how the scheme works and those that have designed it. There is some truth to that because when we look at the numbers, it shows clearly that the larger companies, that those are the ones that do R&D. And the other monitoring tool that we use in South Africa is the National Research and Development Survey, which covers all the sectors, including the business sector. Within the business sector, what we see is that larger businesses are the ones that perform a lot of R&D in South Africa. And the picture is the same here. We also find that the beneficiaries of the incentive have the same kind of picture to say larger companies are the ones that apply for the incentive and be successful because they are the ones that do R&D. I think it's a policy issue also to try and encourage a lot more small medium enterprises to be involved in R&D. There are avenues which they can follow to actually do that. One of the provisions in the Act is that smaller size companies that don't have internal capacity to do R&D by themselves, they can work with the university and fund it for them to access the capacity that there. They can still benefit from the amount of investment that they make. They can work with a science council or CSR as such. As an example, there's a provision that allows them to do that and still benefit from the incentive. As long as they funded it, they can incur expenditure on the R&D, they can actually claim the tax incentive. That's one important avenue that such companies can use. There is also, I think, the question that was raised by Honorable King, that there is other industries that have established R&D formations by themselves. We have cases where companies have clubbed together to actually fund a joint R&D initiative, and they have actually been approved, but they can only claim up to the extent of their funding, the amount of funding that they have contributed to that. There are industries that we are talking to who are in those kind of arrangements, and in those arrangements you find a grouping of larger companies working with smaller companies into a innovative work that will actually benefit the whole of the industry. We find that to be very good, and it's useful that we have a provision that permits that to happen. The question around why is the secretary sitting with so many applications? The challenge, I must clarify, is not with the minister's office. The challenge is at the secretariat. That's where this talk is sitting. And the minister needs to be presented with those. It's either the secretariat needs to catch up on that work, building from the historical backlog, and clear that backlog. Where does the 90 days start? The 90 days starts from the date of application. From the date of application to the... We are saying that in terms of our plans, we would like to say within those 90 days, even if we do it in a shorter time, it's fine. Within those 90 days, a reasonable period, which we thought with the consideration that there was backlog, that we have to work towards that as a minimum standard, but do better after that. You can see, honorable member, that we, on the large part of the applications, we're still not able to achieve that due to capacity constraints, but it's a target that we're working towards. It's something that once we are able to achieve it on a critical mass of application, we'll look at better ways of accelerating the turnaround time. The list of companies, it's not possible to provide a list of companies because we are restricted by law. It's written in the law that even the report that we are presenting here, the minister is not allowed to present it in a way that I could reveal the identity of the company. So with that taken into account, we're not able to provide that kind of information. But the exercise that you have indicated of saying what are the reasons for approving certain applications, I think my colleague here can share some examples of companies that have agreed to share some examples in terms of just to share with the committee what type of projects have we approved. We are able to do that, and we use it when we talk to companies to demonstrate the type of activities that would benefit from the incentive. If you are ready, let me know. The foregone tax in the last year, and those figures, you know that they are sourced from the National Treasury publication on budget review. So by the time of compiling this report, those are the only figures that we had. We did not have figures beyond that. The M&E tool that we use to monitor R&D to GDP ratio, there's R&D survey, national R&D survey that is done by the Human Rights Research Council, commissioned by the Department of Science and Technology to run that survey every year. They produce figures on an independent basis, which tells us where that figure is. We have, I think the minister launched the latest survey results in April, indicating progress in that regard. I'm not sure if I omitted something, but David, if you can touch on those examples, and then I'll leave other colleagues to add where I might have not addressed.
I think if I may just answer a few questions. So on the question of the 150%, just to make clear, in tax terms what it actually means is that for every rand that you spend you get a rand 50 back in tax terms. And depending on the corporate income tax rate that you pay, you may gain a maximum of 14 cents on the rand. So if you're paying a maximum corporate income tax rate, the savings, actual rands and cents translates to 14 cents on the rand. So on a million rand spend on R&D, you're looking at a saving of 140,000. On the question about transformation of the economy and tax policy as far as how it does it relate, so we are creatures of statute, meaning that we can only do what the law tells us to do. And determining R&D is mostly a factual question. So up until the law enables us to consider aspects of transformation, I think we'd be hard-pressed to factor that into our determination of what can qualify and what doesn't. What do we do with applicants that have not been approved? We haven't done enough, considering that the rate of approval is at 49%. Half the applicants can go to other programs like SPI, administered by the DTI, or other programs with us. We are working on that. I think this one-stop shop might be a good solution to that, and we are working closely to see how taxpayers may more fruitfully benefit from the program. As to why it takes us so long to adjudicate things, the process of determining whether a company qualifies R&D means addressing a number of questions. To give you an example, if we had to determine if something is new or novel, that sometimes requires us to do extensive searches, which does take time, and it requires applicants or taxpayers themselves to sufficiently disclose what it is that constitutes R&D. So taxpayers themselves may take exorbitant amount of time to respond, and that adds to the latency as to why we process applications in the manner that we do. And there was a question on the discussion between National Treasury and DST on the progress of this incentive and what are the future amendments. We are looking to mitigate some of the ambiguity in legislation so that taxpayers can fully understand what we mean by the definition of R&D and may qualify
without having, you know, sort of a larger non-approval rate. As to the last point, Godfrey has asked me to explain some of the applicants that have qualified. So we see a lot of applications from the ICT or financial services sector, specifically in banking, and we've seen some fairly innovative products that are coming out of South Africa by way of banking products. We've disclosed some of this in the annual report. And these are companies that are dealing with, you know, the likes of Silicon Valley and Apple in the financial services industry. And they're not traditionally large companies. These are small, medium enterprises that emanate from this province. There are various initiatives there. We're working with industry associations as well, wine industry being one of them. We've approved a company that's working in the wine industry, looking at treatment of effluent, which is also environmentally friendly. So these are sort of flavor of applications that we have approved in the past. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Let me try to do a sweep and also confess that this 150%, even though I was the DDG responsible for it, took me a while to kind of figure out. So I think the two colleagues raised an issue, but I think the third issue to add on to that, which might address some of the questions about why certain companies are not applying, is that the design of the tax incentive is based on profit. If you don't turn a profit, you don't qualify. So in a sense, this 150% is a way of reducing your taxable income. So many SMMEs, many startups, even if they do R&D, they're not at the stage of profit. And they're not necessarily going to be in profitability stage. I would think, as an example, Amazon would not qualify for this tax incentive because they're not profit. They're basically losing money. Uber is losing money. They lose $2 billion a year. So they would not necessarily be able to claim even if they do the R&D. So it's only on the basis of profit. And what this tax incentive does is it allows you to deduct from your profit, so you're not getting direct funding back. You paying government less through tax, and that's the tax revenue program. Now, the 150% is fairly competitive globally. We've seen this. There are some countries now that are going much higher. I think it's Israel that's gone to 300%, and others. But we've thought about this very carefully and taken into account our state of development and what we want to do. It is competitive in terms of other countries, and that's been highlighted. So I hope that's been able to explain. And that's part of the other reason why the profile of tax incentives tends to be more established companies, because they tend to be in a profit stage. Globally, all tax incentive programs, as I understand it, is based on profit. It's based on incentivizing profit. Because if you don't incentivize profit, then you're providing a grant, and that's coming in the DTI space. So hopefully that explains it. The second issue that I want to kind of highlight is that this issue of the minister's desk, it's not on the minister's desk, so we were asked to even change the way that we've written it to him. In order to prepare these letters, it's not simply a case of taking what the adjudication committee has done. The ones that are remaining now are the ones that are more non-approved than approved. The approval letters are easier to do because you say, according to this section of the Act, etc., your thing has been approved, please supply us with the report on this date, etc. The non-approved one is more difficult because the taxpayer, in terms of full and fair reasons, needs to be provided with full reasons. And sometimes these reasons go back and forth to make sure that legally the reasons provided are sound. So the non-approved letters take a long time to produce. I mean, I've seen those letters, assigned them on its way to the minister, etc. So you need to provide full and detailed information. And that's part of the reason where we are at this point in time. But hopefully with the guidelines that we've provided to companies and with the improvement in the formulation of the Act, my anticipation is that as we move forward, we will get less non-approved projects. And this is simply because taxpayers now have a better understanding of what will qualify and what won't qualify. Because we've worked very much with the consultants will help companies to apply, etc. And I think we've already seen it in the IT sector as an example. We had lots of non-approved, but each application we need to provide full and proper reasons for why we didn't necessarily give the tax incentive in that purpose. The 90-day turnaround time, I mean, I think we've tested this out with industry. Unlike other incentive programs where it's kind of mission critical and business would stop, my sense is that industry would not be averse. They are worried about currently we're taking a year or longer to finalize, but there isn't an averseness to 90 days. 90 days is kind of acceptable because there's always a cost and a benefit to this. And this is to highlight that at the moment, we have 6 full-time people in the unit. So they receive the applications, they prepare for the adjudication committee, they write the letters, etc. We haven't been able to expand that unit because as this process changed, about that time we started having constraints on increasing our staff. So in fact, the team is here. Gottfried plays almost half this time and then I'm very little of my time. So in fact, it's a very constrained environment. We need to increase, but I don't think we need to increase sufficiently. We need to balance as well. I've challenged the team to say, can we do this in 30 days? Yes, it would be possible, but you need a bigger center. I think Stini once shared with me that the capacity in Canada is what? 300? For their tax incentive program? And their tax incentive program is the oldest. It's 30 years. So the other point to highlight to the committee is that we are fairly newcomer to the tax incentive program. 10 years is not a long time for a tax incentive program of this type because there's a lot of learning to go to. And that's part of the reason why we had the backlog. Because as soon as we changed the procedure, we got, I think, 300 in October 2012. And they were all of different types. We didn't know what experts we needed. We didn't know whether we have the capacity internally. So I must say we were not prepared. We needed to understand this. And it's been a steep learning curve. And the learning curve was not only on understanding from our side what's R&D. There had to be a lot of learning between ourselves, Treasury, and SARS on what is R&D. The committee spends almost a whole day. They meet every Thursdays. And in the past, it used to take hours sometimes to go through one application because one thing, SARS would say, here's the law. Obviously, they're protecting the public purse. And through that exchange of sitting in joint meetings for over, 4 or 5 years now, there's an understanding of what it is because they have precedent now. We can go back and say, this looks very similar to that, here's the reasons, and we only introduced the experts 6 months after the program came in, which meant that we already had a backlog. So we are dealing with historical, but we are quite confident that by the end of July, everything before 2015, before 31st December 2015, would have been adjudicated. As you can see, there's only 4 left, and those 4, in fact, some of them required more information from companies. So they had to send it back to people, and I think at times the team also had to visit the company. And sometimes companies came to us and say, you don't understand what we're doing. Can we explain anything? We have to work on the basis of your application, to improve your application. So I think we've matured. Companies have matured, SARS has matured, DST has matured, the process has matured, and we're in a much better place to deal with the future, even with the constrained capacity, we do need to increase the capacity. 2 other issues, one that both colleagues didn't answer, not because there were lots, maybe not, it's the double dipping question. There is no double dipping, because if we provide, say, support for manufacturing, we do this to the CSR, and we hardly provide direct grants to companies that they kind of own. The large ones come through the R&D tax incentive, but even in the application form, they have to declare, so that there's no double dipping between what they're doing. It's only on their expenditure, what they commit from their own resources. So we think that is fairly well developed. In terms of the impact study, what we were advised by Treasury and others, and we considered this together with the minister, and we're saying until we clear the backlog, we will complicate an impact assessment because the focus would be on the backlog. So we said let's clear the backlog, and the intention is to do the full-scale impact analysis next year. We have done every year. We do kind of basic impact assessments, like the one we've done now, which sectors are benefiting, etc. But the full-scale impact where we compare ourselves internationally will be delayed till we get the backlog, so that when we engage with stakeholders, we don't get the backlog clouding the decision on how can we make this tax incentive work for both government and for industry, in a sense. And then the final question, which is that I want to address, is the difficult one of the transformation element. I mean, the transformation, when we get applications, we don't necessarily do this. We may want to see, we've been asked, for example, by the Department of Women to say how many women are benefiting from the tax incentive program. It's quite difficult because we don't ask questions. We need to see how we link up with the CIPs. But the issue around transformation is that it would be in all countries, the more established firms, that would have grown to a situation where they can either do R&D and it's part of their program, or they're in a profit situation. I think personally that the better way to address transformation with respect to R&D is not through a tax incentive. It's too difficult. It should be done through more direct grants. So personally, if as a portfolio committee looking at the different instruments we support, I would say that the transformation objectives are better handled through direct grant program. So for example, when we do things like the technology stations program, or when we've done some of the industry innovation partnership programs, etc., those techniques and mechanisms, I think, will give us higher value than a very blunt instrument. A tax incentive is a very blunt instrument. It's difficult. It will complicate the tax incentive to try to address transformation. We should rather increase our budget and say this budget is dedicated to assisting companies in moving up the value chain, and we provide it with direct support. And then the question that Honorable Matila raised, which I think is fundamental, it allows you to handhold those companies. Even with this one and the kind of provisions that Godfrey highlights, that we can't share the names of the companies, etc. So even when they come to us, we can't say, oh, your file, I've seen this. And I said, oh, this program will benefit from my team knowing about it. I can't share it with anyone who hasn't gotten clearance to see those things, because the private sector is doing work in, say, areas like UAVs, drones. We're doing similar research. It would help them to partner with CSR, but we can't do it. The only thing we can do is go back to the company and say, do you know that this exists? Do you know that this program might be of benefit to you, etc.? But currently we haven't done that because the capacity is weakened. I have to add on to say, although there's only 6 people in the team secretariat, we have drawn on technical capabilities within the DSD. So the sections who are responsible for the bioeconomy strategy, for the ICT strategy, etc., sit on the committee. And when they sit on the committee, they do see possibilities of supporting companies with information or putting them in touch, etc. But truth be told, we haven't done this as systematically as would be ideal. We haven't done it systematically because of capacity constraints. Once we clear the backlog, we can, for example, say we think there's an opportunity there. Maybe we should go a bit further than what our mandate is. So I hope we've managed to address all of the questions that have been assumed.
Thank you. I'm not sure if there's follow-up from one of the members, but I think the issue of communicating this program is important. I think Honorable Matela said people would apply, but I wouldn't know that there's something like this that I could benefit. Probably in more rural provinces or areas and stuff like that. But also I think at some stage it will be important for us to have an indication of how many of those that have benefited were women companies or the young people and also people with disabilities, so that then it doesn't focus on one area. People who have all the benefits and all the resources and you know, are in a better position to benefit, when those who are actually deserving and do have those innovation programs in R&D don't even know about it. Yeah. Is there any follow-up from Honourable Members? Honourable Matala?
Yeah, not necessarily a follow-up chair. It's so sure. Thank you. It's not necessarily a follow-up. It's just that they were presenting. I think you talked of 300, one in Israel and the other one, I can't remember whether it said 30 years into the program.
Canada.
Mm-hmm. Because this program is intended to encourage people to do certain things. And I think maybe that's the reason why Israel is, I don't want to say ahead, but you know, they are more advanced in a lot of things that probably I think is because they give this, they have 300 incentives. And if we increase, I'm not saying we must copy what they are doing, but you know, incentivize me enough to do what I ordinarily would not want to do. And if you give me 14 cent, are you encouraging me enough to do something that I can live without? I don't think so. If you can just review that 150, I know people will say no, but we must understand where we are. But if we are really talking about the top end, and it's very clear from what you are saying that this is not meant for me at the corner shop there trying to sell maguinya or to research something to do the bread. You are talking about, you know, the established fellows up there. South Africa, if that is the thinking, South Africa can't be, when you look at it, you can't look at it like some emerging the tax incentive you are talking about is not an emerging economy. It's mainly to the established, and here you have companies that can compete with whoever anywhere in the world in terms of development. You can go to New York and find a company here that can easily go in there and play around, and they've already done so. They're listed in the New York Stock Exchange, but they're having their origins here. Others are in London, but they come from here. So if that is the understanding, so it means then we when we deal with this, we can treat it like any other advanced country, be it Canada or whatever you can think of. So upping the scale, I think it will be in the interest of the of South Africa more than any other thing, because we are incentivizing people who must also contribute towards growing the economy, because this can help in growing the economy. That we say, if we don't grow it, we can't distribute the wealth, we can't transform the economy at the rate that we want to. So this program can help us to deal with the problem of an economy that is not growing, because you can't create new things that will contribute towards the growth. And now that, you know, I'm told we are in a recession, we are in big trouble. So things, the instruments that can help us to check the economy, I think is something worth looking at. It's a comment, it's a question. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And there's also a concerted effort on growing the township economy. And if, you know, this scheme can also, you know, this program, not scheme, could also be linked to that area. I don't know if you want to have a comment.
I forgot you want to, but I think this is a strategic discussion that I'm sure will come up in this portfolio committee time and time again together, because from our budget vote speech, clearly there's a joint commitment for us to work together to increase the R&D spending. The question is, through what instruments would you use it? So partly what I was highlighting before, and I think we need to think about this and do the numbers, etc., clearly, is that if there's additional funding, I wouldn't personally, for now, from the evidence I have at my disposal, necessarily increase the 150%. Because we need to do some modeling. If you increase it to 200%, will you get people to do more, etc.? And we have some of the data, and we can kind of think about that. I think in the short term, where you would get bigger bang for your buck, including in the township economy, etc., strengthening those programs and systems that are aimed at creating large numbers of new enterprises. Good example, we started the work already around this, and the Minister highlighted this during a budget board speech. We're looking at our technology stations program as an example. It's a well-established network based at the universities, and what they do is they provide small and medium enterprises with technology services that increases their work. And that's what many small and medium enterprises want. They don't necessarily want to do their own R&D. They want to be able to know, if I want to change the design of this bottle of water, who do I go to be able to give me my R&D? So I think it's in that areas where I think we would make a much bigger impact around all of those criteria that are very, very important. I mean, women-owned businesses is an example. I would think that the bio industry development center that the portfolio committee was exposed to may be a better opportunity than an R&D tax incentive program, because the R&D tax incentive program is a very powerful instrument. This is what we're picking up from the OECD. But it tends to change behaviors very slowly, because a lot of companies start research programs, they don't do it for 1 year, they do it for 3 or 4 years. So it's a slow moving beast, and I think it's there, and we need to look at how we improve it in terms of its administration, etc. And then building on that, how do we strengthen other programs like SPI and TRIP and the Industry Development Center, etc. So personally, I think that's the debate about what we need to. But overall, we need to be spending more, which I support fully, Honorable Natalia's commitment. We need to increase the share of what we're spending as a country on R&D from the 0.77% to 1.5%. The question is, if we increase it from 0.77% to 1.5%, that additional amount, where would it be best used to get the maximum return? Obviously, we need to grow our human capital development programs. We need to grow industrial our infrastructure program. And then I think these direct support mechanisms, and then continue supporting efforts to increase private sector investment through things like the R&D tax. But I think it's a very good comment noted, and I think I will take it back into our own executive committee to say maybe what we need to come and have a strategic discussion with the portfolio committee around opportunities and options, and what are the trade-offs, and then get your views around those things that will help us think about how we take it forward. So. But thanks for the comment.
Yes, I actually want to emphasize the issue of that there is a portfolio of instruments in place. I think during the budget vote speech, concerns were raised about the one of the programs that has reduced its budget quite substantially, which is meant to protect localization and which is meant to build the capabilities of companies to improve the capabilities of companies also can be a determinant on them engaging in R&D, and most of those are small enterprises that require the technical services that Imran has alluded to. I want to draw the attention of the, if you have allowed me, to the report that was submitted on page 28. There is a graph in there which we share this information on the overall support of government to private sector R&D. We share it with the OECD grouping of countries that are doing similar work, and they compute using the same formula to compare how things are going. The generosity, that graph on page on figure 10 shows the generosity of the incentive. So we can see that South Africa, there are countries that are behind South Africa and a few that are above. It's one of those that when we look at, we say, we are still competitive, although there are some countries that have actually gone more aggressive on the offering that they have, but that is also dependent on the strength of the fiscal to be able to subsidize to those levels. The discussion at the moment with Treasury was that while it's a good idea, it might not be ideal. What's just useful is then to see how we can strengthen other programs that can drive even the transformation that we're looking for in building capabilities of small and medium enterprises, taking into account what we pick up from the monitoring tools that we have, the innovation survey and the R&D survey, which shows us that R&D is concentrated in larger firms, in certain sectors, in larger firms, but then there is a whole lot of small, medium companies that are involved in innovation activities, adopting external technology, buying off the shelf, installing technology to improve processes, to improve design and manufacturing, that are involved in those things, that require a totally different form of support which is available to other programs. Thank you.
Thanks. This shows South Africa being the only African country on the.
Yes.
They are these OECD countries.
Yes. Yeah. Most of the countries that provide this type of incentives are more advanced countries than in the OECD space. And in the African continent, South Africa is the one that offers this, the tax incentive. Mm. We know Egypt is looking at this. And there is another country, I can't remember, I interacted with these countries just 2 weeks back in the NEPAD program. There is another country that is considering introducing, but
Kenya.
It's fairly new. It's fairly new. I think it's Kenya. It's fairly new in the African continent.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think it's Kenya. But I want to thank you for the presentation, the explanation, the response to the question, and for us, this is very important. As a committee, we continuously try and engage, and so that eventually we have a separate R&D budget for R&D, which we believe that will be helpful, and even the monitoring and evaluation will be better controlled and measured. But I also think that this incentive would link well with our IKS, because there's a lot of innovation that comes from there, and in the main are the real people in, you know, the rural areas, and you know, people who are at the beyond of everything who will then be recognized, and I think the IKS team, call them IKS team, in engaging with them should also inform them about this incentive for them to benefit. But once again, Patel and the team, Mr. Mashamba and so, thank you very much for coming, for your presentation. It was really useful to the committee. Thank you. I would just ask those members who did not. Let's just have a 5 minute break so that we can take tea and come and sit down, and then we'll have the IKEA's update. Thank you. Okay, the R&D team, you can stay if you want, you can go if you want, but this team. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, it might not all come because it's a mass.
It looks like a cyclone.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
And if it's a woman, it will
cause havoc.
It will cause havoc.
Mm.
Women cyclones are more aggressive.
But it might not necessarily be the end of it, because you have.
You can start.
Yeah.
Honourable members, IKS team. we can start.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I'm going to do a very brief overview of the meeting between the DTI and the DST. So the much awaited meeting between the DST and the DTI.
Can I just say, it is the document that Shana has just circulated now. Thank you.
As was saying, Chair, the meeting between the DTI and the DST was convened on the 26th of May, albeit a very short meeting. Perhaps for the benefit of the committee members, the meeting was convened against the backdrop of a decision of the Joint Committees of Science and Technology and Trade and Industry. Chair, in the opening statement, the DTI contended that there was a widespread public perception that the IKS bill was intending to repeal IPLA. Mm. That was the first, and the contention was based on a letter that was sent by the DG of the DST to his counterpart at the DTI, and also by a statement made by one of the officials at a meeting at the Department of Environmental Affairs. Regarding the letter sent by the DG of the DST to his counterpart, that letter was merely for information sharing, and it was authored by state law advisors. Chair, we indicated that from the DST side, it would be highly imprudent for the DST to have such a position based on the fact is that the DST cannot repeal an act of another department. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, we referred the DTI to Section 32(1) and Section 32(3), which indicated that the IKS bill does not detract or alter from any right in respect of intellectual property. That is in terms of Section 32(1). In terms of Section 32(2)(3), the IKS bill does not detract from any of the amended laws which formed IPLA. So in terms of that, Chair, the DTI was very adamant that the issue of repealing IPLA was not on the table. So there is no discussion on the repeal of IPLA, given that the DTI and the Portfolio Committee spent lots of time and energy in promulgating the Act. Regarding the issue of alignment, the DST raised the issue that currently there are no policy frameworks that the IKS bill has to align itself. However, the IKS bill aligned itself to the IKS policy, which was approved by Cabinet in 2004. For example, the accreditation and the certification and the registration of IKS is envisaged in Chapter 8 and in Chapter 3. The establishment of the National Office is in Chapter 4. Chair, in terms of the other agenda items, the DTI indicated that it does not recognize these agenda items. Chair, you will recall these agenda items were the letter that you had written to the respective departments in terms of the agenda. So the DTI indicated that that they don't recognize those agenda items because there were issues that the DST raised at the joint sitting. So at that point, the chair closed the meeting. So that's, Chair, very briefly is a wrap of what transpired on the 26th of May. The take-home message is that, A, that the issue of repeal from the DTI side is not on the table. They will not discuss any repeal of the Act. In terms of progress on the bill, Chair, regarding the independent opinion, we have developed terms of reference and we have submitted those terms of reference to our procurement division. It's now in the process of procuring a service provider. In terms of the technical draft, there were quite a few iterations with the parliamentary legal team. I think we now have a refreshed document, and then in the next 2 weeks we can jointly we can present the revised document to the portfolio committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tom, for the update. We have the letter from the third meeting and of the minutes thereof. I think we will work out on our program to resuscitate continuation of finalizing the bill, because I think and our intention and was to bring to the other departments that we are one government. We do not have to work in silos. But in whatever we do, we need to make it easier for an ordinary person to have what we would then call a one-stop shop, instead of being sent from pillar to post. So I think if there is no cooperation from DTI and so we will have to continue tapping and finalize it. We'll debate it in the House, we'll put our pros, why we think that it is the best, and everything has to be located there. But let me give the opportunity to honourable members, honourable Koronov.
Chairperson, thank you very much. It's a pity that you had this meeting before your legal opinion. So I think it's a little bit premature. We have to wait for the legal opinion. If the legal opinion is happy that there is no conflict, and then I think then on that basis we can carry on. But we have to wait for the legal opinion. Otherwise, if you don't get it, maybe the committee must get it. But at that stage, you obviously will go back to DTI. Do they know that you have asked for a legal opinion or not?
Any other?
Thank you, Chair. No, the DTI, they are not aware of the legal opinion. That's the first issue. Secondly, Chair, regarding we actually wanted to expedite the process by having the meeting first. The legal opinion can come later. The only problem with a legal opinion coming from the DTI from the DSD will be most service providers will tend to look favorably at the DTI at the DSD bill. Regarding and in terms of that may be it, and it may even prolong the process. The DTI can then get their own independent opinion, which will be more favorable to the DTI. So essentially, we may be back into a catch 22 situation.
It's not necessarily the case. It all depends what you ask lawyers to give their opinion on. And if he's a good lawyer, he won't dance to the tune of the client, DST, if you're not correct. And we must try to get to the bottom what is correct in terms of legislation. And that is what you should put in your brief to counsel. That is what you want to know. Not that they say you are correct. That's not what we want. It must be such a good legal opinion that DTI, it might go in DTI's favor. We don't know. So we just want legal certainty. I think,
it's the duty of this portfolio committee to do it.
Thanks, Honorable Matale.
I agree with the approach of Honorable Korenhoff, but I'm not sure whether we should not do it ourselves, because the bill basically is with us. It's no longer with the department. It's just that the department is facilitating and making, helping us with our work to be more easy. But effectively, it's our responsibility. We should get the legal advice as proposed by Honorable Korenhoff. Get good lawyers who can give us any advice, and based on that, we then take a decision as a committee whether we proceed with this thing or we recommend to the Parliament that the bill before us has certain challenges, and as a result, we can't proceed with it. And then we will conclude it at that, because I think it's no longer in their court what happens to it. It's in Parliament, and ourselves as an extension of Parliament, we must decide what happens. And in light of what is currently at play, we need a competent legal opinion from practitioners out there. I will support that we get. We must not go to parliamentary legal advisor who go to court there, and they don't know what is whether the head and the tail where it is. We must get smart people who advises us, and I think probably there should be money for the committee to approach legal experts who can help us. We are lucky because Nick has a legal background. You are studying in that direction, so and the prof. Oh, okay, yeah. So they can advise us on the lawyers that we can approach, so that we get an objective assessment. Maybe when we mustn't say next week when we meet, because the time might be too little. But I think as a committee, we must take a firm. This I suggest that we take a decision to appoint through the relevant channels to appoint legal advice on this bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think that's a very prudent approach to take, that the committee takes ownership of the process now. Perhaps we could also share with the committee the terms of reference that we drafted. So I can, by tomorrow, I can forward the terms of reference to you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we'll do that. The wheel is going to share. The building is friend. Now, I think we will look at that to get those terms of reference, and then we will definitely look for an independent legal opinion. And there should be money. We have not used money of the committee. The new year, also the new financial year, to do that. And as soon as that legal opinion is sought, we will bring it to the committee and make a decision thereof. And, to move forward, because we cannot be bogged down. The bill needs to be finalized. Yes.
Chair, just one clarity. The opinion is going to be on the bill which you published in November, or the revised or the refreshed bill.
Maybe look at both bills. And the revised one, and so because the would be that bill that has been published, and
may
I think it will be appropriate if we get a legal opinion based on the latest version of the bill, because you know we must recognize the work that we have done from the time the bill went through to Parliament and referred to us, and what we did thereafter,
mm-hmm.
and where we are today.
Yeah.
So that you know that legal opinion will take into consideration all the inputs that came in. I think it will be better if we do it that way. Thanks.
Yeah. I forgot to mention also that Barbara Lewis, the legal advisor, couldn't she still send her apology today? But she has picked up a lot of issues thereof, and I think, yeah, on, as Honorable Makale has correctly said, we will seek legal opinion on that. The latest that incorporates the other steps that we've been through. Shanash.
Okay, I think the one that's been introduced to Parliament, the first one, would be the basis one, the development one. Maybe we can package it in such a way to show that kind of, we give the legal person a full brief in terms of where it started, what was introduced, because that's always our base. We didn't decide on formally on like a subsequent version where we changed based on some of the inputs that we had, so that isn't the final. We work from the base document, but Barbara can advise, and then we back it up with that one and try to give a full brief in terms of how we got to there, and that would be the I think the process for the legal person.
Yeah, that would be the development of the bill based on where we were to help the legal person. Also not to get it there on top and in applying the legal mind and opinion must know the genesis of this whole thing and the progression and up to where we are, including engagement with the DPI and so forth. But we'll provide all the relevant documents and the relevant progress that has taken place, including the public hearings, including the submission in the committee here, the academic opinion and stuff like that. Okay. So honourable members, we will be notified on when next we
can do it.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I think then that brings us to the end of that program on the issue about the IK bill. I will then ask Shanas to give us progress on the intended submission on the strategy. Shanas? Okay. You can stay if you want. You can go if you want. There's no harm. But thank you very much once again for coming, for weathering the storm, and ensuring that
you
get
a real challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Safe drive to the airport.
If yesterday they engaged the speaker, to consider if some people, if some people should not have a session. So he's looking at,
okay.
I think he's also getting advice.
Advice, yeah. I think it's not fair session because see Abatame. It's really closing on, and it's like that one.
Do you know how to change in the team? That's what?
The main one keeps saying moho green. Hero, thank you. Can you see?
Is that our goal?
Yeah.
I'm very
hopeful. He's sitting in the main kitchen.
Yeah, it's
the blue part.
Yeah.
It's scary when you see, you look at it on the.
Yeah. Oh, this one is
Go to settings.
Yeah.
You have settings. I'm gonna change the pin.
So go to settings.
It's not the pin.
It's what?
It's the you know the wiper.
It's on.
Yeah.
Okay. Leg. It's here.
Yeah. We start with it.
Okay. Let's have Shana's briefing us.
On the international travel, our initial proposed date was the 7th of July to the 16th of July, 17th. I think there has been strong indication that those dates should be revised. There had been some indication that those dates needed to be revised. There were dates suggested by the House Chairperson for another committee that's later in August, two sets of dates that he proposed the committee should travel between. So I'm not sure if we, our committee, would want us to proceed along the same lines, looking at those two dates maybe in August, late in August for the travel.
Early August.
The 17th to the 24th? There was two dates.
The
earlier dates.
I think the second date was the 5th to something. The first date is the 29th of July to the 5th of August. The second date is the 5th of August to the 12th of August. So I said Shanaz must look at the second date, 5 to 12 August.
Okay.
It suits everybody. Okay, we'll look at it.
Okay, so we'll work on something for that date to present the application for the weather warning.
The weather warning. Why don't they
send
you?
We must
evacuate. You know, they say they. I took that letter there. Then they said, hey, you have got doubled once here instead of one. So go and just say, no matter, can cancel and sign. They say, no, you must go and type it back where you got it and bring it back. I say, I hope you are crazy. I'm not coming back.
Honourable members, also the second thing that I wanted to bring to your attention is that remember last year we had the International Astronautical Conference in Mexico, and when we engaged, because apparently it was like science and technology was removed based on, I think in the previous term, that the chairperson didn't take the opportunity thereof. So at in Mexico, Honorable Fabs and myself, we engaged the organizers also of the conference, and we had requested that they should increase the delegation of science and technology. And I think we're just taking it one step at a time. And through the trading industry, the committee secretaries presented, I had a discussion also with Honorable Faps, they presented the motivation to the House Chair. And we then put two people, presented two people with DTI, the trading industry has also sent two people. So we put the name of Honorable Lotrit, Dr. Lotrit and myself as the delegation thereof. It's in September in Adelaide in Australia. So we'll await the formalities and approval or whatever, and the committee will be kept abreast of the development. Yeah. That then, Honorable Matale?
No, I just wanted to say that as a committee we should support the two names of yourself and Prof. Lotrit as our representatives.
Thank you very much, Honorable Matale. That then brings us to the end of this meeting. Thank you very much for coming, for being here, for being safe, and we hope that you'll continuously be safe. But the wind is quiet now, since the trees are quieter. We will see what the developments, but mindful that the storm. I think the speaker has been informed, and she's looking at all options. Thank you very much, honorable members. Have a blessed day.
Thank you, thank you.
Gwen.